Blog Talk Radio.
Rahman Rahim. Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen. Ar-Rahman Rahim. Malik Yawmiddin. Iyaka na'budu wa iyaka nasta'in. اهدنا الصراط المستقيم صراط الذين انعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين امين. I would like to greet our radio audience with the greeting of Al-Quran in the Arabic language. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you. We have with us this evening the Honorable Warith Deen Muhammad, leader of the American Muslim Mission, formerly known as the Nation of Islam. Mr. Muhammad will be interviewed this evening by Mrs. Zarina Bilal and myself, Abdallah Adesanya. This is Mr. Muhammad's first live radio interview on the West Coast, and we are very grateful for this honor. Mr. Muhammad, in September of 1979, you directed the members of the American Muslim Mission to re-enter the economic program of your father, the late Honorable Elijah Muhammad. In making this announcement, you stated that you felt your community had attained the strong moral and spiritual base necessary for success. Many of our listeners will remember the farms, restaurants, trucking firms, and other businesses conducted by the Muslims during the leadership of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. Probably most notable of the products made popular during this time was the world-famous bean pie. Mr. Muhammad, would you explain to us and the listening audience the philosophy and concepts of the collective buying program of the American Muslim Mission as you envision them? And how does this economic program compare or differ from the economic program of your father?
Thank you, Brother Adesanya. The economic program that we are advocating now is really a collective buying program. And I feel that it is no different than the program that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad himself developed or initiated some years back. The purpose of the program is to get the benefit of volume purchase when we pool our money and make volume purchase. We get a reduced the cost is reduced, and in reducing the cost, if we pass that on to the members, then the bite of inflation is also reduced for the members who participate in the collective buying program. It began very slowly, and we like for it to move slowly because it's going to require a lot of research, a lot of study, and it's going to require a lot of discipline on the part of the purchasers so that they don't hurt the program by burdening it with unnecessaries. For example, if you have 100 people involved in a program here in Oakland, mm-hmm. and they don't buy collectively, mm-hmm. but yet they're participating in a collective buying program. By collectively, we mean taking advantage of the group, of the numbers, to get the best buy from the manufacturer or whatever. In this case, it's produce now. We haven't gone into other things. So if they say, for example, if you have 100 people buying 50 different items, yeah. you can't get the result that you would get if you had 100 people buying one item. You see, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad used to encourage his followers to pool their monies. And he began with that particular expression, pool your money. And later, he began to identify his program as blueprint, economic blueprint for the black man. And he said the purpose of it was to get rid of poverty in the black community.
Mm-hmm.
There were other men of our race who advocated the same thing, pooling your resources and getting the benefit of the collective effort rather than having the efforts all dispersed and uncoordinated. It works. It works for many organizations, have had similar programs, and they have established big businesses with their program. It's very close to the idea they call the cooperative buying, co-op buying. But for us, it's different because our purpose is not so much to benefit a few members. It's to benefit all the members who need it, and most of our members need it. Our message at membership is mostly people who are underemployed and out of jobs, you see. So our program is almost a single consumer or a single purchaser's program. We don't intend to get any profit at all from it.
If you don't receive any profit through the program, how will it sustain itself? How will it keep operating?
By reducing the cost to the members, the whole membership gain benefit from that. There are persons in our membership who have such a great desire to see poor people get a little breathing spell or a better situation, a better financial situation, that they will donate their time. They donate their time to see that the program works. So we don't have to hire persons. And if we did, if we needed, say, if we didn't have sufficient numbers to carry out the obligations of the program, what we would do then is select a poor member, and we would give that member perhaps extra benefits from the program, not money. But extra benefits in terms of goods that he'll receive for his family, perhaps without pay. So there's many ways to get the help we need. But we're lucky so far. We have persons like you, yourself, directing the program, and you're not demanding anything from the community.
Yes, sir.
Do you think that the businessmen would be able to be involved in the collective buying program?
Sure. When the program was first conceived, we hoped that the program would in some way reach the need of the poor businessman. And I feel that the program is designed to do that. If we get sufficient numbers participating in the program, the costs for the commodities are going to be greatly reduced.
Mm-hmm.
And this reduction will put us in the position to assist our business people in our community.
Mm-hmm.
If they wanted to have, warehouse sales.
Mm-hmm.
Flea market sales or some other sales, or perhaps even go into business.
Mm-hmm.
If we get the volume, as the volume grows, we could get enough of certain commodities to store for a long period of time. And if they're not perishable,
mm-hmm.
Someone would easily be able to go into business. In fact, many businesses can be created from the program.
Do you think that this program would encourage them to lower their costs?
I would hope that it would encourage them to lower their costs. If we reduce the cost to them, we would expect that they would reduce the cost to their own customers, because that's our problem. We don't have resources to compete with businessmen who have that have great resources. So we open a little small store, and our prices are higher because we pay a higher price for our small volume, you see, and that higher cost is passed on to the consumer. But if we could get the benefit of the numbers that we expect from our community, then that cost would be reduced, and the businessman who participate in our program would be in a position to sell and compete with the average businessman in the streets.
You also mentioned storing food. For people like myself that have never really bought in bulk before, would there be some type of consumer information as far as storing, properly storing food?
Certainly there would be. If we are fortunate enough to realize the program as we conceive it, there would be hardly no storing of anything at all, because we will take orders, and we will purchase to order. We won't over-purchase, we'll purchase to order. We will know in advance exactly what we need, and we'll make that purchase. And the persons will receive that. If anyone wants a quantity larger than they will have, that, then they will, say, a produce, for instance. Mm-hmm. If someone wants a larger quantity of produce than they can handle in a reasonable time, then storage would be their problem, not our problem. Mm-hmm. And we then would have to have some kind of storage information for mm-hmm. those persons participating.
Thank you. Also, I wanted to ask you, what will determine the brand of merchandise or the price and the quality of the goods purchased?
The informed participant will determine that. After we have made available factual information, and then we will leave it to those participants to decide what articles or what items we should buy. I would suggest that we purchase very wisely, and that is economize. There are many, many brand name products that are of no better quality than some brand name products. They don't have any popular brand name, and it would be foolish to spend an extra dollar for a brand name mm-hmm. when you can get the same.
Right.
Without doing that, you see. Mm-hmm. And no frills. We have no frills in Chicago. It's a business operation similar to what we hope that this will develop into. But it's a business. They're working for profit.
Mm-hmm.
They have non-brand names and perhaps a few brand names, I believe. And they eliminate a lot of labor costs, because the customers go and get their products off the shelf and do most of the bagging, everything themselves. You see?
Mm-hmm.
And some of these operations have the customers bring their own bags.
Mm-hmm.
So all that reduced costs. And I believe we can even go further in reducing costs, because our community now has had many years of practice working together and doing things mm-hmm. together. So if we had the space to work in, I'm sure we would have members who would come in, and they've already been in the habit of identifying with the community and with its properties and assets as owner, and that's exactly what each participant will be, the owner.
Mm-hmm.
And with that mind and spirit, they can come in and just do whatever has to be done to keep the cost down.
You mentioned that the program is only open to Muslims. What is your reasoning for that?
Well, it's specifically formulated for the Muslims, but I would hope that Muslims would accept their friends to participate with them if they wanted to in the program.
Mr. Muhammad, you mentioned in your article in September of 1979 that the reason for reentering the economic program of the late Honorable Elijah Muhammad was because you felt the community had the necessary strong moral and spiritual base. Why is that important?
Well, I think the downfall of most businessmen, not just true for those of our community or for Afro-Americans, I think it's true for most small businessmen. Their downfall is usually because of absence of lack of discipline. Too many of us go in business and we have that dream that we are going to now have money to do what we want to do, and we get gross income, and we don't understand that money in the first year or so of our business really shouldn't go into my pocket at all. It should go back into the business. So we take that money and we spend it on the things that we've been dreaming about. And in a year or so, or sometimes in a few months, we out of business. And they say, oh boy, these people can't make it with business, you know. Yes, we can make it with business, but we don't have the business sense that those long-established Irish families, Jewish families, and others have, you see. Mm-hmm. They bring their relatives in and everything, and they expect nothing from the business until the business gets strong. So sometimes we can get some income right away from a business, but most businesses take a long time before you can develop that business and get some income from it. You have to have investment capital. So as a group, we can muster up investment capital. And if we wisely care for this program and don't try to get anything from it in terms of wealth or capital for ourselves, but the object of the program should be to reduce the cost of living for the individual member, and let the business people then go into business, and with good advice and good information. I think we should have business counsel for this program to assist small businessmen, and we have businessmen in our community who are knowledgeable. We have businessmen who are very successful. And if we have to, we will seek outside assistance, you see. And we can avoid the kinds of difficulties that the average businessman get into just because he doesn't have the information that he need at hand before going into business.
It seems to be a unique quality, at least in the African-American community, that we are looking at, as you have envisioned the program, the nonprofit motive being held by the people who participate, such that the program puts a lot of faith in volunteer activity. And as you've expressed it, that faith in volunteer activity is based on knowing who owns the program and who the benefits are coming to, that the participants reap the benefit of the program.
Certainly they are the owners.
Mm-hmm.
Adesanya, if we can spend a whole life, make a career of preaching good morals, of preaching religion to people, in the face of the economic conditions that we have been in, as far as I can go back, you know, as a race, as a people, and now it's affecting many other nationalities are affected by the same conditions that we're affected by. If we can spend all our life making a career of preaching, then shouldn't we spend some time reducing the inflationary costs on people's life and making it possible for them to have some dignity? The man has no dignity when he is dependent upon welfare, when he's out of job, and he has to get involved in unlawful things. Sometimes they're not unlawful, but they're beneath the dignity of the individual. Mm-hmm. And you have a strong moral sensitivity in the poor people. And we forget that.
Yes.
They don't like to do the things they have to do. So we have to really do whatever we can, do all we can, to bring a more human situation into existence for our poor, suffering people in these cities. We can't do the job by ourselves, but we can do something. And the collective buying program will certainly help to alleviate the situation, I believe.
It seems also that you are directing the person to participate in the collective buying program to think of buying in a different mode than they have in the past, and buying collectively only one or two items at a time. And we're normally used to filling up a shopping basket at any of the large supermarkets. It seems that there's a different kind of discipline that you're asking of the participants. Would you elaborate a little more on that kind of discipline?
Yes. Now, you know, we can't impose a program on people. They have to want what we are offering them, you see. And I find that most of the members of our organization, they really want what this program is designed for. If we just spend our purchase instinctively without serious thought, we buy more than what we need. We buy too many different things. I might want, say, string beans today, you know, for dinner. But I don't have to have string beans today for dinner. I can eat peas, green peas, today for dinner. If we buy collectively and we say we have string beans Wednesday, we'll have green peas Thursday. Well, in the long run, we get what we want anyway.
Yeah.
You see? Mm-hmm. And pretty soon our habit is conforming to the program, the needs of the program. You know, we'd be in the habit then. Well, I expect peas then. I don't want peas on Monday anymore. I'm in the habit now of eating peas on Thursday. You see? So if we can retrain our appetites and our habits, we can get great benefit from the program.
Yeah.
Where people all purchase together, and there's nothing wrong with that. Once I wanted to have some hash browns, and I came downstairs, and my wife was fixing French fries.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, I was going to have a hash brown this morning. I said, you fixing fries? So she said, you want me to fix you some hash browns? I said, no. I said, I'm not going to waste all that oil and gas. Give me some French fries. You already got them ready there.
Right.
So we have to do things to reasonably bring the cost of living down for ourselves.
Right. Very wise.
There was also a question that was asked whether or not this program would bring jobs into our community.
Well, it certainly will through the business angle of it. That arm of the program that will be designed to assist businessmen and getting the real wholesale prices will certainly bring jobs in, because these will be businessmen They won't be operating none for profit. They'll be paying taxes, and they'll be employing people.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and it will bring jobs in. In fact, we have a lot of faith in that. The bigger part of the program will be, in the long run, it will be the development of businesses and jobs.
Thank you.
Yeah, looking at that development of businesses and jobs, do you see the collective buying program itself becoming a profit-making venture?
No, I don't. I would hope that the collective buying program would never be a for-profit program.
Mm-hmm.
That it would always be a non-for-profit program, so that the many members who will never go into the kinds of businesses that the program would allow will still be able to keep the cost of living down, because we need that very much.
Mm-hmm. How will you control that? Will you encourage the members to keep in mind that this is not a profit-making venture?
Well, certainly. We would expect that our members would participate in this program with a sacred respect.
Mm-hmm.
For the disciplines and the rules and regulations of the program.
Mm-hmm.
We see this as really part of our religion.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, economic concern is one of the pillars of our religion. Yes.
Is it possible then that by developing the strong sense of commitment to economics that are for the upliftment of the community as opposed to a profit motive, that this will serve as a rallying point for many others who are non-Muslims in the Bay Area and other areas to...
Yes, I've been told that. I've been told that. I've been asked that question many times. In fact, in Chicago, I was on a program, and they asked the same question, radio program, television program. I've asked the same question. There is a chance that people may join the program just to get the benefit. We're going to carefully screen people that come into this program, and they're going to have really very disciplined habits. They're going to have a lot of self-discipline to participate in the program. So I don't think we're going to get persons that would hurt the program. And I wouldn't care how many came in if they were sincere people, and if they came really from the poverty-stricken area, community of the people.
Mm-hmm. Finally, I guess as a final question, presently the program is operating on foodstuffs or produce. Do you see an expansion of the types of items, of the types of goods, and are purchases limited to our immediate locality, or is there a possible opportunity for international concerns here?
Mm-hmm. As our demand increases, we will then begin to search out manufacturers in the States who can supply us with the greater volume of commodities or items that we would be purchasing. And I'm sure that we are going to have an occasion to look in the international trade market for some of our needs.
I'd like to thank you, Brother Imam, for your agreeing to come sit with us in the discussion. We hope that in the future weeks ahead, there'll be opportunity for other statements. We'd like to also, for our listening audience, if there are other questions about the collective buying program, you may address them to myself, Brother Adesanya, or to Mrs. Bilal at Oakland Masjid Muhammad. The address is 1652 47th Avenue, Oakland, California. The zip code is 94. 601.
And you've been listening to the program of the American Muslim Mission, our speaker, Warth Deen Muhammad. For more information, call 436-775.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين الرحمن الرحيم مالك يوم الدين إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين اهدنا الصراط المستقيم الصراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين آمين.
By Sister Afifa Mohavi and myself, Brother Adesanya. This is the second in an historic series of interviews with Imam Warth Deen Muhammad. As Muslims, we believe in all the prophets of God and in the divine books that they brought, the Torah, the New Testament, and Al-Quran. Muslims believe that every nation has been sent a prophet with a message of truth. For our first question this evening, Imam Muhammad, in your topic, the universal moral theme in Al-Islam, the thought of oneness comes to mind. Do you see creation as being one regardless of nationality, denomination, or creed?
In the Quran, we are told by God the Most High that the humanity is one, that we descended from one nature, one human type, and that he made from that nature male and female, and from them spread many children to populate the earth. So we believe very much like the people of the book, the others who believe in the revealed message of God concerning the oneness of humanity. Humanity is one. And also, the human nature is one. Essentially, when you're talking about the essential nature of the human being, that nature is one for all. And the symbol of that nature, I believe, for all the great religions, especially for us, is the human heart. And its nature is taqwa. Taqwa, that's an Islamic term. And I now would like to go to Dr. Muhammad Muslihuddin's book titled Morality its concept and role in Islamic society for the definition of that term, taqwa. On page 49, I quote, "Heart, as said the Prophet, is the seat of taqwa." And this makes it clear that taqwa, in its real sense, is the fear of God which springs from the human heart and expresses itself in righteous deeds. The fear of God is not the fear of a coward or of a child, but of an adult who wishes to avoid harm to himself and to others, end quote. So this idea of taqwa is really the base of Islamic consciousness. It is, has been stated by Dr. Muslihuddin. And God says in the Quran that He has not given any human being two hearts.
What does it mean that He hasn't given human being two hearts?
That we're lying to ourselves when we're living an unrighteous life.
Imam Muhammad, are there any basic differences in the morality code of Christians, Jews, and Muslims?
Yes, there are some basic differences. One basic difference that I think perhaps might be just a difference on the surface. It might not be, technically it might be a difference, and it might be a difference in the way that the two religions express themselves, or the three religions express themselves. Morality in Al-Islam rests upon the content of motives. As it is often said, repeating, quoting what the Prophet himself taught, peace and blessings be upon him, and I quote, "Matters are judged by intentions." That is to say, human nature is innocent, and it is the conscience that is responsible, the free will and the human conscience and free will to choose, to make choices. It is responsible. Adam had no resolve to commit sin. And that's what we read in the Quran, in our holy book, the Quran. Adam had no resolve to commit sin. So there is a basic difference, I believe. We don't consider Adam a sinner, but one who slipped, one who made a mistake. Morality primarily addresses the influences, or the influence from the external on our human behavior, on the inward sensitivities. It brings us to study our inward responsiveness, that is, the responsiveness from within to outside stimulus. When we fail to respond as our inner heart, inward nature, bids us or moves us to respond, then we are subject to get in the habit of doing things wrong, and eventually the habit of doing wrong becomes like a second nature to us, but it's not our true nature. And perhaps there is a difference in the way different persons of the various or different religions look at this idea of the tendency to sin in human beings.
Would you please explain to us, what is the end result when a people chooses to ignore the questions of morality in a society?
What is the end with?
The end result.
End result?
Yes, sir.
Of not choosing to follow the higher moral nature? The end result is corruption, confusion, the oppression of self. We put ourselves down, and we put ourselves under oppressive forces when we refuse to let the moral nature rise free and clean as it wants to.
Imam Muhammad, in 1980 you gave a lecture in Seattle, and the topic of that lecture was Why Religion? Would you share with us how you see the function of religion as it serves to establish goals for society, and what relationship do these goals have to our subject this evening of morality?
Morality is the heart of religion. Universal morals, when we understand them, are really the message of the revealed religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Al-Islam. Such values that we find under the heading of universal morals or universal morality weigh heavily upon us and force us to free ourselves from narrow, unfair viewpoints. Ayah 135 of the Surah An-Nisa is an example of such a universal moral theme. I read now this ayah from the Quran. O you that believe, be a people true and consistent with the principle of justice, witnesses for Allah, though it be against yourselves, or against your parents, or the close relations, or whether it involves a rich or a poor person, for Allah is nearer to both and best to judge over conflicts. End quote. So Ayah answered that question by saying, in this ayah, we see morality expressing itself in the proper behavior with others in society. It's not morals, not really a question of the individual. Morals are a question of our interactions in society with other individuals. We can be pretty peace and safe with ourselves without much pressure on our moral judgment. But when we have to interact with other people, live in a family setting and live in a community setting, then the demand on us is greater to exercise good moral judgment.
When we talk about the relationship of morality and the individual, what role does the individual's conscience play? You mentioned earlier that humanity is one, and as we are discussing these topics, we're talking about all men and all women. So what do we mean when we say the individual's conscience and its relationship to morality?
First, we mean his deep-seated human sensitivities. But after we are introduced into a civilized, a highly refined culture, and I consider our modern society a society that was given civilized morals, virtues, refined ideas of what proper behavior is. And once we're introduced into a society like this, then the obligation of the conscience is to follow that guidance. So I would say conscience for the individual in society is obedience. However, no society can be safe with individuals free to act and free to form their own judgments unless there is an unquestionable authority for the members of that society. So we come back to the idea of God. Obedience to Allah is the best obedience. And whatever we ask of the individual, we should ask that in the name of Allah. Then we will have some guarantee that the society will be safe and those virtues, those good morals, won't go out the window.
Imam Muhammad, in researching the social development of mankind, one finds the Quranic moral injunctions in various societies prior to the revelation of the Holy Quran. Would you please explain this phenomenon?
Yes. I believe Brother Adesanya, in his opening statement, explained it. We are, in our religion, we are expected to accept that all people have had their messengers, that the Creator of all of us have given all people basically the same human excellence, the same capacity, and He has inspired messengers and even women. The mother of Moses, the mother of Jesus were inspired women. They were given messages, not on the prophetic plane with Moses and Jesus, with the major prophets. They were not instructed to convey a message to the world, but they were inspired and they were given a message from God. So we believe that the one God has revealed His will to many, many nations, all of them, in fact. Some of them can't, they have no record of it, but we have to believe what God has said. He has not ignored any people.
Imam Muhammad, many people who claim to lead morally accountable lives say that they follow no organized religion. What is your opinion on this matter?
I think that question comes from the absence, come because of the absence of any clear definition of religion. When religion had a meaning that was pretty clear for most people, you didn't hear that kind of statement. But when religion became almost a fad for many people, and many established churches, established religious organizations began to cater to that fad tendency in religion, then people got lost. Many people got lost. This happened over the last 10, 15, 20 years. Many people got lost, and then we start hearing people express these kinds of things about religion. That there is religion and religiosity and religion to separate the true religion from the fads, from the religious fads, the artificial religions. I would like to say that many of these emotional developments and spiritualized kinds of developments that we've seen recently in religious people. I'm not, in my opinion, religiosity, false religion or artificial religion or religion that's not true to the real meaning of the term religion, but an attempt on the part of the individual to find his spirituality, to get in touch with his true spirituality. I would say astrology would fit that classification. Yes, sir. Because many people take astrology and follow it blindly and follow it with a trust that they should only put in Almighty God, so it becomes a religion for them.
what is it in the human being then that directs them to search out things other than religion to meet a particular need they have, to submit their will to something beyond themselves? For example, astrology, looking at the planets, tarot cards, wise philosophers.
It's an expression of the need to find internal, inward peace. That's what it is. And it's an indication that the environment, the society, is not helping them, but confusing them with their ideas of God and religion.
I see. Many of our listeners may hear us talking about the religion of Al-Islam and yet wonder, if Al-Islam is a universal religion, why are non-Muslims excluded from the holy city of Mecca?
That's simply because that sacred precincts there is a symbol of the purity of human nature, human being, his purity, and also a symbol of the aim, the end aim for all for all the righteous people. It is to live and be in an environment that is conducive to their spiritual or religious persuasion, to the life that they choose to live. If non-Muslims come in that area would no more be a sacred or holy area. It's a sacred and holy area. Muslims that go there, they're supposed to be people who respect the sacred precincts and people who bring no unclean thing in there, bring no unclean behavior in that precincts. Muslims themselves will be forbidden entry into the holy precincts of Mecca if it's discovered that they don't have the mind, attitude, and spirit to really conduct themselves in the best way while they're in those precincts. So we can't ask people to follow our religious disciplines, our religious rules and regulations that are not of our religion. And if we allow them to come in there, then perhaps pork may be brought in, liquors may be brought in, things that would profane the precincts.
Imam Muhammad, many Americans may agree that Al-Islam has some good moral principles, but cannot accept it because they believe it was spread by the sword or by oppression. Would you comment on their feelings?
Well, I would say that's part of the pollutants of the fallout from the Crusade days, and we have been poisoned. The atmosphere has been poisoned by those erroneous charges made against the religion. I would rather than answer that directly, I'd rather stay with the idea of morality and universal morality as the central theme in our religion. And I would like to answer it by going again to the Quran and the saying of the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him. In the book, and Nabawi, the 40 hadith, pardon me, on authority of An-Nawas bin Sam'an, may Allah be pleased with him, the Prophet said, peace of Allah be upon the Prophet, and I quote now from this book, good morality is righteousness. Good morality is righteousness. And wrongdoing is that which wavers in your soul, and you dislike having it disclosed to others. Now I would like to go to the Quran and read in the Quran the statement on righteousness, so we understand what righteousness means in the context of our religion. Surah Al-Baqarah 177, and I quote now, "It is not righteousness that you turn your faces toward the east or west, but it is righteousness to believe in Allah and in the last day, in the angels, in the divinely revealed books, in the divinely sent messengers, to spend of your earnings and possessions out of love for Him, on your kin, on the orphans, on the needy, on the child of the road, on those that beg, and for the ransom of slaves, and to be steadfast in prayer and practice regular charity, and to fulfill the contracts which you have made, and to be firm and patient in times of pain or suffering and adversity, and throughout all periods of panic. Such are the people of truth, the God-fearing, are those who have what we mentioned earlier, taqwa."
Thank you.
Imam Muhammad, what role do you see this country in general playing in the universal moral scene?
Our country, America, what role do I see it playing in the general world, international moral field? This country was born out of the need to find more moral freedom, religious freedom, moral freedom, human freedom. And this country has played a great role in bringing more clearly to the eye and consciousness of the human being in this country and throughout the world the real meaning of freedom and the real meaning of morality. But as we all know, there has been a conflict, a very serious conflict, in the progress or movement of human appetites and aspirations in the American civilization and American society. And that conflict we see in the enslavement of our foreparents, the years of Jim Crowism, in the treatment of races toward each other, not just blacks. So we see that on one side we have a strong movement advancing morality, advancing human dignity, advancing freedom and democracy in this true sense. And on the other side, we've had the poor blind souls, poor neglected souls, poor ignorant souls, self-blinded souls, pushing and pushing and pushing for their own narrow objectives and not caring about their fellow man. But when we look at America's history, we have survived all that, and in spite of that, we have progressed. And the same people who were once slaves now have very, very special roles in society, and they do have a greater sense of dignity than many of them ever thought they would ever have. So I would say America is playing a great role. Democracy, truth, and morality is winning out.
Imam Muhammad, in your earlier comments this evening, you mentioned the importance of the individual's use and accepting responsibility of morality. Can you give us some thoughts for the future, where we're going from here, so to speak?
Yes, I believe the conditions in the world tell us that the mood of the people in the world tell us that we are coming closer and closer to a season of the predominance of universal morality, where people will consider what is best for the whole before they go out to do something to injure their fellow man and bring trouble to the whole.
Thank you, Imam Muhammad. We've been certainly inspired by the words that you share with us this evening. For our listeners, our topic next week will be the Islamic diet and the Islamic dress code. You may address questions concerning this evening's broadcast to Sister Afifa Muhaibi or myself, Brother Adesanya, at Oakland Masjid Muhammad, 16552 47th Avenue, Oakland, zip code 94601. I leave you with the greetings of peace. Assalamu alaikum.
Let your soul arise. Take